I will be describing you my Java prototype for efficient and general purpose dynamic software planning. These were joint work made with Michael Hicks from University of Maryland and from Lisbon. So this is the motivation that got us started. If you look at the related work about dynamic software updating systems for Java, you'll see that we started with custom JVMs that imposed a really high level of overhead, but still they were able to perform dynamic software updates. Of course, the research community stepped in and developed these nice DSU systems, but they still require a custom JVM, even though they impose low to no overhead. Recently, there are some prototypes of dynamic software update systems that do not change the JVM whatsoever. They use stock JVMs. However, they impose high overhead because they use proxies, for instance. This point in this design space remains pretty much unexplored, and our question was, why is this? Is this inherently impossible? What are the challenges? Or what happened here? So we set out to design Rubot, which has these two main design goals. It must sit completely outside the JVM and not change it at all. Just use bytecode rewriting techniques and reflection and other tools. And it must impose low overhead both on steady state execution and when installing an update. This is a brief overview of Ruba. We have several states. Obviously, our program is running in one version. An update eventually comes, and we signal that program to stop, and we enter the stopping stage. Once that program stopped safely, we migrate the program state so that it is compatible with the new version. Then we restart every thread that we stopped previously, and once in the new version, and once we did that, we are now running in the new version. The strategies for each of these states, well, for running, we want to impose low overhead on steady state, so we must avoid proxies at all and other heavy techniques. This work actually is quite related with Kitsune, which is an update system for C that will be briefly discussed later on a different presentation. So we inherited the technique to stop the program and to restart the program from Kitsune, which is the update points and the control flow migration. We'll see that later on. And to migrate the program state, I introduced the concept of the update class, which makes it really easy to specify the program state conversion. Over this presentation, I will talk about an updated program and updates that were made to that program. That updated program is it's the H2 database engine, which is an open source 100% Java SQL database. We used releases as versions, and we used these three releases, and we used the TPCC benchmark to measure the imposed overhead. All the tables that we use are in memory. So, how does the code actually look? The first challenge that I showed you is how can we stop safely. Here we have some code from H2, which is the server thread that actually handles all TCP connections from clients. We have a run method, and we start by negotiating the protocol parameters with the client, and then in a long running loop, we process each one of the client's commands. Obviously, there is more code to it. There is this transfer object, a socket. The transfer object is responsible for initializing the connection, and there is a process method that keeps processing each SQL command. Where in this program can we stop the program safely? Well, if we look closely, line 10 seems like a good candidate because the state is quiescent. I mean, we have already negotiated the protocol parameters, and we have finished processing the last client's command, so there is no in-flight state. The developer signals that to Ruba using Ruba's API. This is called an update point, and it has a unique label that identifies this update point. We shall use this label later on. This is all it takes to identify update points. How much manual effort do update points take? So this is, each number here is a file from the H2 database. And to support update points for a version of H2, we had to change 4 files and a handful of lines of code in each one of these files. You would be expecting only ones here, and there are numbers bigger than one. This is because of some fancy exception handling that we had to take care of when doing those update points. So now the question is, once the update is finished, once we have loaded the new version and converted all the program state into the new version, how can we restart the program in the new version? Again, we inherited Kitsune's control flow migration, in which every thread gets rerun from the start, and we also rerun the main method. And we do that until each thread reaches the same update point in the new version in which this stopped previously. When every thread reaches the same update point, we say that the control flow migration is over and we are now running in the new update version. However, if we do that in this code, it is obvious that it is buggy because we'll try to negotiate the protocol parameters with the client again. And the client is here, he is expecting a new command to be issued. So it might crash and disconnect. To avoid that, Ruba has some API calls that allow the developer to know if this thread is running from code or if it is running from an update, if it is recuperating from an update. So basically, we have to guard this block of code with the check, and we're good. Again, how much effort does the control flow migration add to supporting an update, to supporting Ruby in a Java program? Even less than update points, only 3 files or 4 files, and even less lines of code. This is not all the manual effort that we had to do to support Ruby on the H2 database. We also had to do some miscellanea and some non-blocking I/O. So in Java, when you interrupt a thread that is waiting on a socket, that socket gets closed. And that's really bad for performing dynamic software update because you want to get that connection, to keep that connection. So we had to use non-blocking I/O and actually perform a select operation on that socket instead of, and now we can interrupt the thread that is selecting a socket instead of directly interrupting it and closing the socket. So we had to implement non-blocking I/O on top of H2 and also some build files and some other miscellanea. This is our toolchain. So we start with the bytecode of version 0, that is the first version. We run it through Ruba's analyzer and get a version descriptor. It is just basically metadata from version 0. And we use the driver tool to load that version 0 onto the JVM. This driver tool changes the bytecode of every loaded class on the fly to inject new behavior and new support for a future dynamic software update to be installed. So it is expected to add some overhead on steady state execution. That is when the program is not installing an update. This measures how much steady state overhead was introduced. So we took the H2 vanilla for a certain benchmark, and that is one. Then we measured how much non-blocking I/O, how much overhead the non-blocking I/O version would add on top of that. We were even expecting a small speed up here, but it turns out we were wrong. We have about 1% overhead. And on top of that, we have all the transformations that Ruba injects to the original bytecode that add about 8% overhead. This is when the program is running at steady state and not installing any overhead, and not installing any update. Now, a new version comes along. For instance, let us look at a code example. This is in version 1.1, a class page store, which is a page store that reads and writes pages, and every time it writes a page, it increments a counter. In the next version, we add two new counters, one for each time the page store is read, and these write count bays actually add the semantics of the previous write count. When we open a page store, write count is 0, and write count bays has some number, and then we only increment write count. So semantics here changed, even though the name and the signature of this field remains the same. So we take the compiled code, run it through our analyzer tool again, but this time we feed the previous version descriptor to the analyzer tool. We generate a new version descriptor and an update class. The update class is a stub class in source code. that allows the developer to come in and customize, fill in the blanks of this stub update class to specify how to convert the state from one version to the next. It compares both versions, detects what changed, and emits dummy initialization code. However, if you look closely, you'll see that there is this V0 and V1 package out of the blue. These are called the skeleton classes and are generated also by the analyzer tool. And this allows the developer to refer to each version of the state uniquely. And basically, skeleton classes have the same structure, the same skeleton of the original classes. However, all fields are made public, and all methods have some dummy implementation. Note that the skeleton classes are not meant to be executed. They are just meant to satisfy the Java C compiler to generate the binary version of the update class. So how can we migrate the program state from the previous version to this one? So basically, we have to copy the field write count to write count base, and we have to set the new field write count to 0. As you remember, this field changed semantics. How much manual effort to perform this on our H2 experiment? Here we can see the size of the update classes that we needed for version 1.1.1.2 and 1.2.2.3 in lines of code. And we can see how many were actually customized and changed by the developer. When I say lines edited here, I mean this. Ruba got it right, and the developer just had to fill in the blanks. When I say lines added, I mean this. There is some missing line in an existing conversion method that the developer had to add. And also, we have new conversion methods that Ruba was not able to detect. For instance, in one version, we had to reload all the property files because some property changed, and we had to add a new conversion method to do that. Everything else remains pretty much unchanged, and with 30 lines of code, we get the job done. The update classes up from above look a bit like this. The developer goes in into every generated method and customizes some fields, adds some extra initializations, or adds some new fields. If you want to see this in further detail, please meet me. I can show this to you offline and we can discuss it. So now that we have the update class, the new version descriptor, and the new version bytecode, we feed all of that to our updater tool. And the updater tool connects with the driver tool through the Java debug API and installs the new version on top of the driver tool. So now we've covered every phase of the update process, except we don't know exactly how Ruba migrates the program state. We just know how the developer specifies that migration. So Ruba performs a custom heap traversal throughout the old heap to find the outdated instances and migrate them to the new program state. It starts on the root references. A root reference is a field on a live thread object or a static field of a loaded class. And imagine that we have this program heap. Ruba also uses an auxiliary data structure to map objects from the previous version to the new one. So Ruba starts by discovering this object. Now, Ruba maps classes and creates a new class for the new version of this object. The relationship between the two classes, they can be as unrelated as possible. The bottom line is that the update class must be able to carry the program state from this object to an equivalent version and initialize it in this object. This way, we are completely unrestricted as to the flexibility of Ruba in terms of types of changes supported. We support changing the class position in the hierarchy, adding fields, removing fields, everything you can think of. So once we map the classes and allocate a new instance, we do this using an unsafe operation that does not run any constructor. Ruba copies all the state that it can match from the old class to the new one, and then old object to the new one, and then it runs the developer specified conversion code. Once it does that, it tries to traverse the new object. In doing so, it discovers yet another object. It maps, copies all the fields, runs the conversion code, tries to traverse, fails. This is done. Once we traverse completely a field, we fix that reference to the new object, obviously. Then we find yet another object. Again, map, copy, run the conversion code, reverse, and now we find an object that is in the table. Obviously, we won't try to migrate this object again because it has been migrated already. So we just fix this reference and we're done. Then we fix this reference, we're done. We're done here, fix the static reference, and when we finish traversing the heap, we lose all references to our auxiliary data structures. At this point, the garbage collector will kick in at any time and collect that as garbage, and also collect everything in the old state as garbage, and we're done. We've migrated all the state in the heap that was updated. Actually, this does not paint all the story. There is an important part to it that completely surprised us, that is hot swapping. So hot swap is built-in DSU system in the JVM that allows us to change only the bodies of every existing method. Only the bodies. We cannot add new methods to existing classes and we cannot add new fields, but we can change the code here. So you've seen that page start changed, and we had two different classes that were unrelated. So we used hot swap in this case to change all the references in the bytecode from the previous version of PageStore to the new version of PageStore, and this avoids us from copying memory around just to create new objects, just to be able to update the state. However, turns out that hot swap takes a big toll on performance. When we measure the time to actually install an update. Here we can see that we take 3 to 8% to stop the H2 database when it is running. Then, as expected, we take a long time to traverse all the heap, find all the instances, and perform instance migration. And we expected that to dominate a lot, like 80 to 90%, but it didn't. Turns out hot swap takes a long time. This was completely unexpected. Finally, we restart, as I've shown you, and it takes about 10 to 11 seconds to be able to install an update. However, H2, being the database management system in SQL that it is, there is an alternate method to update. Remember that all the tables are in memory, so if we just stop and restart in the new version, we would lose all the state. We did an alternative method in which we dump all the database state as a bunch of SQL commands. Then we exit the process running in the updated version, relaunch it in the updated version, and then we import the program state from the SQL version. There is no I/O to it. We are always inside this cache. The SQL file takes like 5 megabytes or not even that. So any I/O-related latency here is negligible. Well, good news for Ruba. We can beat this process that we expect the industry to use or something similar. And we are able to retain the open connections. So there is a client doing a benchmark on this database while the database itself is updating, and that client did not get disconnected. In fact, that client didn't even notice that the update had occurred, except for this big 10-second latency on the next operation that it issued. So, in conclusion, I've shown you how Ruba is designed to use a stock JVM and is able to install updates using a stock JVM. It imposes low overhead on steady state, but it does impose a long overhead pause. Our next steps are obviously to improve the update pause times, especially that hot swap latency, probably by going into the JVM and implementing more efficient hot swap mechanism, but we are exploring other ways to do that. And also, we want to tackle the time taken to migrate the program state by using parallel updates or, as I've shown here, lazy updates. That is, we start the new version immediately after copying the code, and we do not convert any program state. And then as the new version touches outdated instances, they are converted on the fly. And the pause would be just to convert the application's working set, and we expect that to be much lower in size than the full heap. We are working into that. Also, we want to further improve steady state performance. I mean, 8% is good, but 0% would be the target. And also apply this to more programs and more updates. I've shown you a single program with three updates. Someone has talked in previously about game servers, which game players are really naggy about those lag spikes that really ruin their game. So the challenge here is how we can install a new version without adding any lag spike. And also, for instance, a BitTorrent client. I'm open and looking forward to new ideas. The BitTorrent client, the idea is that we take a long time to find other BitTorrent clients and build this huge distributed hash table to be able to reroute our packages. And if an update comes and we have to lose all this state that took us so long to generate, and this state is intrinsically transient because it's open connections, we would lose a lot. So BitTorrent clients could also benefit from dynamic software updates. Thank you. That was all. I will take your questions now.
So this question is actually inspired by the keynote. You did a good job of talking about what the costs of this were. What's the benefit? So what's the business case for this?
So the benefit is that you have a server with a bunch of clients connected to them, like an SQL server, and you don't want to lose that transient state, the connections. You don't want the clients to disconnect just because you wanted to install a new update.
But you might have another instance of this server running somewhere else? And
yes, but for that you would need redundant hardware, an extra hardware, and with Ruby you can do that without requiring that extra hardware. You can do it just on a single process.
So the environment you envision is not in the cloud, it's in a dedicated hardware?
That is a tough one. It could be in the cloud, but even in the cloud you have to update single processes.
Yeah, but I mean, the cost of a new processor, so the alternative is to allocate a new process.
Yeah.
On a new virtual machine. And so your costs are intended to reduce the cost of allocating a new machine.
No, of losing the transient state that process keeps.
But I can keep the old one running, generate a new one with the new version that I wanted to have upgraded, and let the normal session degradation and load balancing move things over.
Okay. When we developed this, we did not envision the cloud environment.
Okay. What are your risk analytics for the open question is, are there systems where you're running them, you have state in memory that you don't want to have to lose, you don't want to have, you have a long-lived connection, it's going to be there for hours or days or whatever, and you don't want to let it just die for some reason, or maybe you have an in-memory database that's sitting there, and so you might have gigabytes of state, and so if you have to stop and restart it, you lose all that state. So I think there are potential use cases, but I think it is an open question how important these are, given that people do need to do load balancing at the start. But I think there are some. We have time for another question.
Just a technical question. Were you able to convert a type of a data structure to another one after an update?
For
example, an integer float, can you do that?
Sorry?
From one version to another.
Were I able to convert?
Yeah, so you have the state of your program
as
an integer, for example. Can you convert that to float?
Yeah, sure. Actually, there is this object that was a thread server that changed from extending thread to having an inner thread from one version to the other. That is a tough one. You are changing the position of that class in the class hierarchy. We are able to support that, and it worked out really fine.
Okay. Any more questions?
So did you investigate the problem with the hot swapping the method bodies was slow? Do you have any insight why that is?
Yeah, I think that hot swap is used mainly for debugging purposes, in which you are in an IDE debugging, and now you want to change the body of this method and you are seeing. So it is really optimized for that case. When you try to do a bulk hot swapping of 200 classes, it takes the time. It is not optimized for that.
Each one individually. Yeah. And the op for each
so
one.
We measured the time that it takes to hot swap a single class and the time that it takes to hot swap a bulk of classes, even though we have API for that. And it turns out that it is multiplying the number of classes by the time it takes. So this gives out that definitely there is something to be optimized down in the JVM.
All right.